Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. There is almost no place in American society today in which they are not on the virtual menu. You can go for a ride on a Milwaukee County Transit System bus or a hike in the Grand Canyon and probably see them. I'm wearing them right now, in fact. We're talking about headphones, which have been part of our oral landscape since 1958, since the first stereo phones were invented by a Milwaukee entrepreneur, John Koss. After 65 years, a lot has changed about headphones, but a lot has not changed. Michael Koss took over as CEO of the Milwaukee-based Koss Corporation from his father more than 20 years ago. Koss joins us in the studio now to talk about the state of the industry. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let me start with a really basic question about headphone engineering. I've got these headphones on my head. We have headphones arrayed around the studio. I have earbuds that I bring on the bus with me. Is the point of headphones to replicate exactly what a speaker system does on a smaller scale, or is there something distinct about headphone technology versus just recreating sound to a larger space?
When father started the business back in 1958, he really did it in order to create a personal listening experience. He had created this phonograph player he could carry around the house, and he wanted people to have the opportunity to listen to their music without disturbing anyone. But something very interesting happened when he created that first stereophone, that first SP3 stereophone, and that was he put people closer to the music than before. And when you think about it, music from speakers mixes the sound all over the walls of your living room. Stereo headphones mix it in your head. So it's a very decidedly different experience.
Well, and frankly, you could be sitting on a stage in the middle of an orchestra and listening to the music around you, and you still wouldn't have the same sound that you get from headphones. So how do you sit down and say this is what sound ought to be?
Right. Well, it has a lot to do with keeping things in their proper perspective. And that, I think, is a very important part of what we do, because if you create something that sounds awkward, in other words, if the piano sounds large, too large for its shape and size, if a flute sounds out of proportion to the piano, you don't have a very good headphone. And it's very easy to do that because you can have parts of the frequency response range that are facing forward, that are standing out. We don't want that to happen. We want things to sound natural. But the ear is also very weak at certain frequencies. And if you take that into account when you're designing the headphone, you can recreate a much more lively experience with a headphone than you might get even at a live performance.
Let me ask you this, not asking you for any proprietary secrets here, but you know, you're sitting on an airplane or something and someone sits down next to you and you tell them that you run a headphone company and they ask, how does a headphone work? How does a headphone work?
Well, you'd think it's very, very modern, up-to-date technology, but it's not. The systems that we're using today in a headphone were really created by Alexander Graham Bell back in 1871. It's an electromechanical device, and not a whole lot has changed since then. In fact, the most sophisticated product we make today, the electrostatic headphone, was also patented in 1871. So it's a very, very old technology, and it's electromechanical. And when you look at what we're trying to create with a headphone or with a speaker, is we're just trying to move air. So a headphone transducer is no more than a bandpass filter. It's nothing more than a light bulb, basically. You feed electricity into it, and you expect it to perform in a certain way. In this case, it's vibrating. The diaphragm is vibrating, and it's pushing sound. In the case of a light bulb, it's making a filament glow in a vacuum. But they're no different. They're really bandpass filters.
Is there an upper limit or maybe if we're talking about shrinking things down, a lower limit to first of all, how much smaller this technology can get, and secondly, a limit to how good something that either fits over or in your ear can sound?
Right. What we have seen are some very diminutive transducers created for the hearing aid industry. And I think people that use hearing aids will tell you they weren't really designed for reproducing sound. They're for music. They're really designed specifically for human speech. They're trying to increase the intelligibility of human speech. So those transducers are tuned at very specific frequencies, in fact, that where most people lose their hearing. The part that gets damaged, unfortunately, is the part of the hearing where you lose the ability to discern sibilant sounds, the S sounds. And so that's what's accentuated in these little tiny transducers, which are called balanced armature transducers, which we don't use in headphones. We tend to use the same old electromechanical device design that was first created to move a lot of air. The more air you can move, the better. And when you think about it, there's a lot of air to be moved. A 32 hertz bass note, for example, is about 32 feet long. That's a lot of air to move. So we want to have a diaphragm that can respond properly and move enough air to give you that nice deep bass and still tinkle on the highs like you'd like.
So it doesn't behoove you to make something too small?
Well, if you do, you have to take very, very precise cautions not to tune it up so it sounds like a toy. It'll start sounding nasally, and it'll start sounding really diminutive in size.
You mentioned hearing loss, and I'm sure this is a big issue in the headphone industry. We hear a lot about, anecdotally and with scientific studies, that people tend to listen to things too loud to the degree that over time it can damage their hearing. Is this a field that that your industry is able to contribute to? Is there a way to make headphones such that their ability to injure hearing over time is that you mitigate that at all?
Not really. We funded the Koss Auditory Center for Research and Treatment out at the Medical College. And if you ever get a hearing test out there, that's where you have it done.
I have indeed. Yeah.
And we learned a lot from working with the folks out there. One thing that's pretty interesting that people don't realize is you have to have spikes, what we'd consider to be louder spikes or higher frequencies, where you'd say, gee whiz, that's too loud. If something goes over 97 or 100 decibels, that's a terrible thing. Well, if you're at a concert and somebody crashes the cymbals on the stage, it's going to exceed that level. The problem with noise that we know is when it really is continuous at a specific threshold. That's where the damage seems to be done, unless it's really an impact noise like an explosion where you could actually cause some sort of concussion to dislodge parts of the ear. But when you have really extended exposure to frequencies in excess of, I think, the OSHA standards they're talking about, you're not supposed to go much over 87 to 90 dB for an extended period of time. That's not really good. And you can't really limit the headphone's peaks because if you did that, everything would clip. You'd never be able to hear the top. The high frequencies would all fall away. So there's no way to do that. What we did do is we created a device at one point called the SafeLight that would illuminate, and it would tell you if you were listening at 95 dB, for example, because you shouldn't really do that. We recommended not doing that for more than 4 hours a day continuously. It's the drone, the continuous drone that causes a problem. And people don't realize, you know, they expose themselves to riding around in a convertible or riding on a motorcycle or going to a fireworks display or blowing off fireworks or shooting guns when kids are, you know, younger. These things are really detrimental to your hearing. So you have to be very protective of that.
How much of successfully producing headphones or earbuds is about recreating the sound, and how much of it is about shutting out all the other sounds around it?
Well, there are two different kinds of phones. One's a circumorophone, like the one you're wearing right now, that blocks out any sound from coming in and getting out. And then we could have a superorophone or a hear-through type phone or what we call high-velocity phone. They behave completely differently. The circumorophone that closes out sound really contains all the frequencies inside. And the open phone allows some of the high frequencies to escape through the ear cushion. So you actually hear them not only directionally from the transducer, but they actually wrap around and you get the impression that they're reoccurring because they're coming back at you from the reticulated surfaces of the headphone themselves. What that does is it opens up the sound field quite dramatically. And so if you close your eyes listening to a circumorophone, you tend to get a much narrower sound field. Now, we can do things to the headphone to open that up, but why? You can buy a headphone that's closed for that experience. You can buy a headphone that's open for a different experience. So if you want to have a nice wide open sound field, get an open type phone.
Can you talk about ergonomics and designing? I mean, I would imagine that when you're talking about designing earbuds or, you know, exercise style earphones for someone, ergonomics play a different role than when you're designing a big over the ear, like what I'm listening to now. How specific are you getting when it comes to different ear size, different ear shape? Everyone's ear is a little different.
We have found something very peculiar about people when we've interviewed them about the use of their headphones, and that is that they'll make excuses for themselves, which is really peculiar. I mean, if you had a pair of shoes that didn't fit right, you wouldn't say, oh, my feet are just too big, or my feet are too flat, or I have big toes. You'd go out and find another pair of shoes. In the case of headphones, people are very it's very common for people to say, gee, this headphone doesn't fit because I have big ears, or this headphone doesn't fit because I have a large neck, or my hair is too long, or I wear glasses. And so they're apt to change and try different headphones, different styles, and that's why we keep continuing to design other styles. And we focused intently on making the fit correct because of that. Most of the people we compete with have lots of problems with fit, and we try to move around that. So this consistent search that people have for fit is kind of interesting. And the excuses that they make for themselves is also quite interesting. So it's a never-ending challenge to make something as comfortable and really acceptable to as many people as possible.
When we spoke with Dara Torres when she was in town for your event launching this particular line of fitness earbuds aimed at women, that was one of the things that that we talked about, is this notion that women's ears are different sizes than men's to a large degree. I mean, how much of it is marketing color and style to women versus size and shape?
Right. There's no doubt I can go out and find a woman's ear that's bigger than mine, okay? And I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3". But it's also possible I can find a lot of women with smaller ears than mine. And what we found was a consistent concern that women expressed that the earbuds that they had didn't fit right, and that they were falling out, that they didn't fit in their ears correctly. And when we looked at it, there was a propensity for these ear canals to be slightly smaller. So what we did was we reduced the size of that earpiece by 30%. That's pretty significant because we had to continue to move air at a smaller transducer. But the consistent complaint and the consistent concern was there. So we decided to do something about it. And for years, no one's done anything in this business about what the women's market. I mean, I remember coming up through the industry, and if a woman walked into a hi-fi store, a classic hi-fi store, they didn't get any help because men figured that were running the store that women were not really serious shoppers. So we think this is an important step for us to do something that's specific for women. So we engaged women to help us design the product.
How has the proliferation of lower-end headphones and earbuds change? You know, you go to a discount store, a Target or a Walmart or any big box store like that, and there are a million headphones and earbuds on the wall there. You must feel the pressure to compete against the smaller and lighter and cheaper headphones.
Right. It really did a couple things to the industry. First is it turned a lot of the products into disposable commodities, which is unfortunate. A lot of them came along with MP3 players or CD players or portable radios and things, and they had very limited life because they were very inexpensive. They were just thrown in as a second thought. So that was one problem. But something else happened, which is actually quite exciting, is that we found that people began using multiple headphones for multiple purposes. So it isn't uncommon today. In fact, when we've done research and said, bring your headphones in, we want to talk to you about your headphones, when we do some research, some qualitative research, people will bring 6 headphones in. They'll bring the headphone in that they wear at night at home. They'll bring the headphone in they work out with, the one they travel with, the one they wear at the office, the one they commute with. And the proliferation of these different sizes and styles and the fact that they can go through them and afford them has really opened up a lot of different applications, which is quite interesting and quite fun for us. When I started in the business, you bought one headphone, it sat at home, and it was only used part of the time because you were wired to the home stereo. That was it. Today, there isn't anything that doesn't have a headphone jack in it.
Where does innovation go next?
Well, the biggest thing that we've done, and it has a lot to do with that research I talked about before about customizing the experience and customizing the fit. The other thing that really was borne out in that research was people complaining about wires. They really hate wires on headphones. So we've actually created the first wireless Wi-Fi headphone, and it's called Striva, and it consists of a small Striva core, which is a collection of Wi-Fi components about the size of a dime. And this can make an independent connection to the Internet and work like a web server and serve you music from any location on the earth, provided you have an Internet connection. And that's been a multi-year plan. It's taken about 4 years to get us where we are now, but it's the first of its kind. So this will be really, we believe in the future, this will be the way people will listen to music, because there will be no need to have any connection or plug into anything else. You just put the headphone on, you'll be connected to the Internet.
I would imagine there is only so much you can do for a set of earbuds that requires you to have a cord that goes into your iPod or MP3 player. It's just going to get tangled.
Right. That's correct. We've tried just about everything.
Finally, one maybe oddball question. You go to the COS website and you have headphones for purchase. There is also classical music available for purchase. And the question came up, is there a Dvorak fan in the office? Is there something about that particular selection that speaks to COS headphones?
I put that together with the orchestra back when Zenek McCall was here. And of course, we had a really terrific opportunity to do Eastern European music, particularly Dvorak, because Danny was Czech. And at that time, when we started that project, if you looked at the catalog of material that was available on CD, there were almost no American orchestras. I mean, it was a wasteland. And it was really difficult to get American orchestras recorded. So we put together a program with the Milwaukee Symphony, and we put those discs together. And then I did the same with Indianapolis and then with Grand Rapids. And that's what the catalog was all about, and that's why we did it at the time. You know, there's been a proliferation now of recording, although it's still tough to get a good, solid recording contract with anyone other than the top five orchestras in the United States. We wanted to change that, and we tried to change that back when we put that program together.
Do you find a lot of people still taking you up on those, ordering online?
They order online, but and the nice thing about it is it never goes out of style. But it's, you know, classical music business is a small part of our business.
Well, Michael Koss, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Michael Koss is CEO of the Koss Corporation, the Milwaukee-based headphone manufacturer. There is a link to more about the company at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The piece we are hearing right now, by the way, is Movement 3 from Dvorak's Symphony No. 7, performed by the Milwaukee Symphony as part of the Koss Classics series back in 1990. One last break, and then the author of a guide that deconstructs some myths about bicycling. Grant Peterson says, "Just ride," after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM.